It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, former Wisconsin Badgers linebacker Chris Borland joins the show to share the new athlete storytelling platform he co-founded. First, the comedian Roy Wood Jr. hosted this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner. He delivered a speech that was half comedy roast and half social commentary. Speaking to a room full of reporters and editors from some of the biggest publications across the country, he pointed out one of the biggest problems he sees in the media industry today.
All the essential fair and nuanced reporting, it's all stuck behind a paywall. People can't afford rent, people can't afford food, not healthy food, they can't afford an education, they damn sure can't afford to pay for the truth. Say what you want about a conspiracy theory, but at least it's affordable. I mean, well, unless you Alex Jones, it'll cost you about $900 million. And I understand that we have to put the stuff behind the paywall because creating the truth is important. People can't afford the truth, but you all can't afford to go find the truth for free.
Wood's speech highlighted a challenge journalists face when it comes to funding their work. Quality reporting can be expensive, it takes a lot of time, and online ad revenue alone generally isn't enough to pay for it. Paywall subscriptions can generate the kind of revenue needed to pay for in-depth journalism. That can create, though, an information gap between those who can afford to pay for quality reporting and those who can't. It's a problem that outlets around the country are struggling to work through. Some are experimenting with new and creative ways to fund their work while keeping their reporting as accessible as possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get frustrated when you run into online paywalls for that article, that one article that you want to read? Do you subscribe to some publications, local, regional, national, that have these kind of paywalls? Do you feel like you miss out on quality journalism because you can't afford to subscribe to these services? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. This summer, she'll take over as the new director of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be here.
How big a problem do you see this being, that there may be an information gap between people who can afford to subscribe to news services and those who can't?
I think that there's always been a problem with that, with having balanced and reliable information. People subscribed to the newspaper in the 1950s and 60s, and people who could afford it did, and people who couldn't afford it didn't. So the gap isn't necessarily something that's new. What's new is the malignancy of conspiracy theories, misinformation, disinformation that is free. So this is now available to us online when it wasn't in the 1950s or 60s when my parents were subscribing to the Milwaukee Journal.
Are there things about the economics of the news media now that makes it more of a reach for people, especially to get local reporting that's valuable to them, given the economics of the situation?
Yeah, the economics for local news are not pretty. And it relates in part to a loss of subscribers, but also, importantly, a loss of advertisers. So if you look about 10 to 12 years ago, we were at about 12% of the national ad spend. So everyone from your local car dealer to Dove soap was going toward local news. Now that number is about 2%. So you see advertising going to other places, including targeted social media advertising.
Now, the information gap we started with was between those who could afford a subscription and those who couldn't. How about between places that are maybe bigger cities that are packed with media outlets and smaller towns, rural communities? Is that so-called news deserts? Is that an information gap you worry about?
It's absolutely an information gap that I worry about. News deserts are very, very serious in places like Wisconsin and, in fact, all over the country. But one of the things that some research is showing is that those news deserts have increasing polarization, because they don't have the local news outlet. They're sort of nationalized in their politics. So rather than thinking about who's the neighbor I want to run for the local school board, they're more heavily fixated on, say, a Senate race in Georgia, because their news sources are more nationalized.
Let's look at different possible funding models for, you know, the online age of news. Now, for a while, there was the idea that we're going to do it all with web advertising, online advertising, which means we're going to have so many stories that go so viral and we'll get so many clicks. And how's that worked out?
It hasn't worked out. We have not solved the advertising conundrum for news in any way. And so we do have to look at other funding models. Part of that's going to be philanthropy. Part of it is going to be looking at things like nonprofit approaches, and then also public media, like we're on right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about paywalls? It seems like news outlets, some of the big national newspapers, have enough of a subscriber base, enough of a reach that that is a viable model.
It is, especially depending on your audience. The Wall Street Journal probably has the most viable paywall, given that a lot of businesses pay for its subscriptions for their employees. I think you are seeing some real thoughtfulness and some ethics and integrity coming into paywall discussions now, particularly when we went through COVID and people needing all of that information. Most outlets put that information outside of the, in front of their paywall so that you didn't have to pay to get it. And so now I hear from some editors and publishers who are saying, you know, hey, maybe it makes sense to have the latest Green Bay Packers Aaron Rodgers trade behind the paywall, but I'm going to put this election information out in front of it because, sadly, some people are more likely to pay for Packer info than they are to figure out who to vote for.
I know this isn't a brand new concern with the internet, but is there a worry that, okay, if I know a certain group of people can afford to pay for my web service, for my newspaper, I'm going to craft my news to appeal to that kind of customer?
Sure, to appeal to that kind of customer, and then also to appeal to what's the most clickable. Are we getting more sensationalism? Are we getting less substantive coverage? Those are all really important worries.
Do you think we are getting more of that? Because I know I've talked on the show about, you know, the 1800s, a newspaper publisher who had a great series on the discoveries of life on Mars with surprising detail. Like, sensationalism isn't new. Do you think it is in some ways worse now?
Sensationalism is not new, but it has more reach than it used to have. In some ways, less reach because we do have fewer super powerhouse, everybody, you know, watches Walter Cronkite kind of figures. There's more atomization, so there's more choice. But those things that are bogus are getting better reach now.
Talking to Kathleen Culver from the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison, looking at access to news, affordability of news services in the modern media age. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you subscribe to a physical newspaper? Do you pay to see the stories behind paywalls on your local newspaper, a big city newspaper, one of the national outlets? Does it keep you away, a paywall, from seeing stories you want to see? Call in and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Allison in Madison couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know about the importance of libraries in accessing news and whether that's changed with online paywalls. Now, a lot of libraries do have subscriptions to periodicals and daily papers.
I love Allison's question because I could not possibly be a bigger fan of the public library. You know, when we talk about news deserts, one of the things that we think about is what other civic institutions are important in bringing us together, in getting us to talk about the local soccer team, to pay attention to the new business opening. And I think that libraries are one of those critical civic institutions. And they are places that we can access information, reliable information, for free.
Thanks a lot for that question, Allison. You also mentioned, Katie, outlets saying, okay, maybe that Packers news, you got to pay for that, but the election news, we'll let you have at least some of that for free. I know during COVID, some paywall outlets put the daily COVID tracker information in front of the paywall, not behind it, so people get it. What other kind of distinctions could we make between, okay, this is our public service and you can have it for free versus this is stuff you got to pay for?
You know, it's such an important and vital question. And I bump into it sometimes with people who contact me because someone has tried to share something with them and they used to be able to access it if it was shared via social media. But a lot of outlets have now changed that practice as well. So I think vital civic information, there's an argument for that to be in front of the paywall. But then also each of us as citizens asking, what investment are we making in news? And that you may not enjoy your local news outlet, and it may be too expensive, and you don't want to place your investment there. Are you maybe making a donation to public media? Are you looking at other ways to support news? Because it's not just on the news media to fix this problem. All of us who need that information have to be invested too.
We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Katie Culver about online paywalls and the costs of quality journalism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you're in a news desert in some ways, where, especially maybe for local news, local government news, you don't get a lot of reporting on it, maybe not as much as you used to? And at whatever level, do you subscribe to a newspaper, whether in print or online? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Katie Culver, professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're talking about journalism behind paywalls and the conflict between access to quality reporting and how to pay for it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What kind of reporting are you willing to pay for? Is there something that you subscribe to? Love to hear what it is. Would you be willing to pay more for a particular kind of journalism, a particular coverage maybe in your local area? What questions do you have about how journalism is funded or not funded in some cases? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@WPR.org. Katie, you mentioned briefly earlier there are nonprofit models, not just public media, public radio, and public TV. What kind of things do you see out there that look promising?
I think the Salt Lake Tribune is one of the more promising nonprofits. Startups, it's a long-standing legacy paper, mm-hmm. But they went to that model a few years ago, and they are making it work. Right here in Wisconsin, there's the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism at wisconsinwatch.org. They do phenomenal work. There are a number of those peppered across the country. But they're not easy. This is not easy to make these go.
Yeah. Have we seen some come and go? Are there failed models of nonprofit attempts at journalism?
Sure. Plenty of them. And I think we have the opportunity to learn from those. But we also need to be sure that there's an audience to support that nonprofit approach. There are some that are tremendously successful, in fact, winning Pulitzer Prizes and the like. I'm hopeful in part, but we need to invest in it.
Something I wonder about, something I worry about is, you know, every community has county board meetings and city council meetings and school board meetings. They can be a little dry to sit through in person. I've been there. But that kind of coverage can be really important, and it might be the most important for some people. It's what's happening in their backyard. Do you see models that work in communities that may not have a huge, you know, population to begin with?
I do think there's the possibility for citizens to get involved. We're seeing more of that activity going and looking at school boards, for instance. But you're right. When there is not systematic local coverage, there are all sorts of shenanigans and malfeasance that could go on. There's the tiny community of Bell, California, lost its regional newspaper reporter, and within a short span of time, some very powerful people there had bilked their citizens out of millions of dollars because there was no journalist watching.
Let's go back to our callers now. Barry is with us in Green Bay. Barry, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Barry?
Yes, I'm interested in your conversation. I equate having a subscription to your local newspaper with patriotism. I mean, I know that the media has been called the fourth estate. I can't imagine that any of the other three, portions of the government would in any way be functional without having a critical media. We've seen evidence of the fact that now the judiciary has rejected the scrutiny of the other two branches of the government, and what other alternative is there but to have the media shaming them continuously? And it's going to take years probably to get that judicial institution to begin to actually shine the light on its own.
Gotcha, Barry. Thanks a lot for the call. There's a Thomas Jefferson quote, I think, that I'm
going
to butcher here, but something like, I'd rather have a press without a government than government without a press, something like that.
Yeah.
That reminds Barry's thoughts. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Barry is spot on, and thank you for recognizing the role of journalism. Now, that's not to say that journalists always get it right, mm-hmm. that they always serve as the best check on other powerful institutions. Sometimes they're very much in line with other powerful institutions. Mm-hmm. But I think we have example upon example of example here in Wisconsin and across the country where we are served as citizens by the work of journalists who do their job with integrity.
Thanks a lot for that call. Chris joins us now in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Yes. So first off, I just wanted to say thank you to NPR for putting a spot on this, as always. Terrific. And second of all, I don't know if my wife and I are kind of the exception to the rule, but we are constantly, regardless of paywall, trying to seek out the most fair and honest reporting to make the best judgment of government or what's going on locally. So unfortunate as it is, and as much as I disagree that it shouldn't be, journalism has to be funded in some form. So if we have to, we're happy to pay for it if need be.
And Chris, may I ask, do you and your wife subscribe to any particular outlets?
We run the gamut. We go around the country. I'd like to go to look at what's going on in L.A., San Diego, New York, Chicago, to try and get a feel of what's going on around the country, and it helps give a balance to what a reporter might be bringing forward.
Chris, thanks for the call. Katie?
You know, I think, Chris, thanks again, Chris, for being a great news consumer. I think you raised an interesting point that makes me remember I should have pointed to two other things. So really in the area of antitrust, that's something where news organizations are held up by law from cooperating and setting subscription prices and that sort of thing and subscription agreements. So, you know, as Chris tries to look at Arizona, L.A., wouldn't it be great if he had one central, you know, news subscriber account where he could go to all of these other outlets? You know, everybody is like, oh, I pay for this Gannett paper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but I go to the Gannett paper in Tennessee to try to find out what's going on there, and I can't log in. So I think that's an important element. And then also related to antitrust, news outlets have not been able to band together to deal with big tech when it comes to setting ad rates. And that's a real problem. There was an effort to push that forward, a bipartisan effort in Congress last year. It went down in flames, unfortunately. But that's something that we're going to need to look at, too.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Katie, for years I was hearing like, okay, we're right on the verge of microtransactions for media. So, you know, I'm online a lot for my job. And hey, there's this cool article in the Miami Herald or Philadelphia Inquirer. The model was supposed to be I could put $50 into an account and I'd open this article for $1. That seems to have disappeared. I haven't heard anything about that lately.
Well, a lot of us were hopeful that if Elon Musk were living on planet Earth instead of on Mars, that's what he would have done with Twitter. He would have turned it into a micropayments platform that actually could have helped support publishers for the work that they do put out. I haven't lost all hope, but again, we're not going to see any forward motion on that when we have antitrust restrictions on publishers.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Katie Culver from the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics, looking at how we pay for our news, whether we pay for our news. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us now in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi. Say, there's a site on the internet called archive.is. It's pretty easy to get to. It's about a week behind, but almost every article printed in this country and around the world is posted on that. It's a free service. And like I said, it's about a week behind, but it's, you know, if you can't afford it, you can afford this.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen links to this. I'm not sure how it works legally and or ethically, Katie.
Yeah, there's some real intellectual property questions around this. But some news outlets are trying, testing being part of free services to bring people in and then drive them to other content and bring in more eyes on their ads. So just be careful. Anything that's offered for free, always ask what's the quality of that and do they really own it?
Speaking of, thanks again for that call. Speaking of, you mentioned the links between social media and journalism. Obviously, a lot of people on social media share links to journalism. A lot of questions about how the money flows, who ends up profiting from this. The infamous pivot to video from a few years back where Facebook basically single-handedly persuaded newspapers to start doing more videos that I think hardly anybody watched. Your thoughts on social media and how it's affected journalism?
Well, it's affected journalism in a lot of ways, but one of the ways that I like to point to the most is that it's important to think about ethics right now, not just in terms of journalism, but in terms of all public communication. So, you know, journalism is my life, and I will love it forever. But it's one piece of our information ecology. And if the other pieces of that ecology are toxic, then we have problems. You know, I noticed in the news break leading in that we saw that we were hearing a news story about an amazing rise in youth voters. That is not driven by local newspapers. That is driven by TikTok. And so if we have a prayer for the future, it's got to be that all public communicators feel a sense of responsibility to truth and to minimizing harm and the like.
Yeah, that's it. It's a constant dilemma, even for us at public radio. How much do we do on a social media platform? How reliable is that platform as ownership changes, whether that's Elon Musk or a Chinese company owning TikTok? How are you seeing journalism outlets try to navigate that?
I think a lot of journalism outlets recall very well the hard lesson they learned with the, quote, pivot to video, and almost universally lost money on that experiment. So I think there's a little bit more of a conservative approach now, but definitely an emphasis on younger users, readers, viewers, and bringing in that audience. And given that they're more politically engaged than their predecessor generations, maybe they will turn more to news. I can only hope.
In just our last minute, what do you have your eye on now? What is on the horizon that has you excited and or worried or both?
Actually, that youth engagement does have me very optimistic. My glass is very half full with the generation that's coming through my classrooms right now. They're smart. They want to be informed. They want neutral information, and they really care. They want a world that aligns with their values, and that makes me very optimistic. Now, if I can just convince them to read up for something other than answering my news quizzes, that'd be great.
Katie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to be here.
Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the role of online paywalls in news coverage and how we can make high-quality reporting financially viable for news outlets and their audiences. Coming up after the news, a new project aims to share the stories of college athletes in their own words. Star UW-Madison football player Chris Borland is a co-creator. He and his partner joined the show to tell us about it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we can't always avoid angry people in our lives. We can do something to avoid explosive interactions with them. We'll talk with UW Green Bay's Ryan Martin, also known as the Anger Professor, about some of the roots of anger and strategies for dealing with these situations. Now, the ways we get to know our favorite athletes are changing. Back in the day, if you wanted to learn more about the players scoring your team's touchdowns, home runs, and jump shots, you had to wait for a reporter to sit down with the athlete and write up a newspaper feature or a television package. Or wait for a quick biography to come out about your favorite player, as I once did with Detroit Tigers pitcher Mark the Bird Fidrich. More recently, though, players have started taking the storytelling process into their own hands instead of relying on traditional media platforms. It offers the potential for more unfiltered access into players' lives and personalities, but some media critics say it can feel more like public relations than fully objective truth-telling. Olivia Hancock is a co-founder and head of operations for Buy Us Media, a new athlete-driven storytelling company. And Chris Borland is a former All-American linebacker for the Wisconsin Badgers, also a co-founder of Buy Us Media. I talked to them last month. Chris, as a former player yourself, what has you so interested in creating platforms for athletes, in this case at the college level, to share their stories directly with the public?
Well, I think one of the overarching themes in sports over the last decade plus has been athlete empowerment. I think you've seen it with Naomi Osaki and other athletes kind of owning their narrative and sharing their story from their perspective. In my experience, I think while playing at Wisconsin and the NFL and afterwards, sometimes, you know, coverage was filtered through the opinion or perspective of the journalist that was writing the story. What's neat now, I think, particularly with young athletes, Gen Z and college athletes, is that they're content creators. They're used to putting out their story. I'd worked at the Players Tribune and saw some of the good that they could do there. And what Olivia and I want to create is a platform where athletes can speak directly to the public on what's important to them, what their experience is like. And I think really importantly to Olivia, it's easy to put your story out there by yourself, but we want to create a community where athletes can share their story with fellow athletes across the country. There's almost 500,000 college athletes that compete under the NCAA banner. So there's no shortage of incredible stories out there, and we want to create the platform where athletes can share theirs.
And Olivia, with all that in mind, can you tell us what it is that By Us Media is doing?
Yeah, so By Us is going to be a platform that empowers college athletes to share their story in their own words. We're primarily focused on stories that involve topics off the court or off the field. So rarely you'll ever hear about stats or scores on our platform. It will be topics like family, teammates, mental health, outside of sport hobbies. And Chris and I have been spending the last 6 weeks already traveling across the country, meeting with college athletes and capturing their photo without their jersey on. We've been capturing their photos and helping share their story in their own words. And we've already been to Duke, Oregon, Arizona State, Iowa State, and others. And we're going to be heading off on another road trip in the coming weeks. So it's, yeah, really exciting stuff, and we're just getting started.
I didn't hear Wisconsin on that list, Olivia. Is there a plan to come to UW-Madison, your alma mater, and other schools around the state?
Yes, there is. We have been to Wisconsin. I guess I look at Wisconsin as the home base. So when I'm thinking of where we're going,
Excellent. It's
usually we're leaving Madison to go somewhere else. But we do have some stories on the way with a women's hockey player at Wisconsin, and they actually just won the national championship this past Sunday.
Talking to Olivia Hancock and Chris Borland about their new project, an athlete storytelling company called By Us Media. Chris, you've already shared some of the stories online. One powerful one, an athlete with connections to Turkey and his reactions to the horrific earthquake there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a basketball player on Drake named Okai, and a story that we were introduced to recently, and a really powerful one. His family, his parents grew up in Turkey, met there in school, and actually his folks lost some loved ones in the earthquake. And this was something that had been mentioned only briefly. I think Drake Athletics put out a video, Okai and a fellow athlete at Drake, a Turkish women's volleyball player, wanted to raise some funds and awareness. But what we were really fascinated in was, this had happened, this tragedy that Okai had personal ties to, in the midst of a historic run for Drake. They won their conference tournament for the first time. They were competing in the NCAA tournament. And it was just something that he was trying to juggle in his life. And I think that's kind of the power and importance of what we want to accomplish. It's really that what athletes are experiencing personally. His was a dramatic example. We'll have another story out tomorrow on a women's basketball player from Iowa State who helped start South Sudan women's national basketball team. Just an amazing person. And she wrote about identity, trying to fit in while often sticking out, mental health, and just the reminder that she's a human first. I think she's done a lot of wonderful things in her life and can be kind of cast as a hero or a symbol for something, but just really wanted to focus on her mental health. So there's so many incredible stories. Not all are so heavy. There's some lighter and fun ones, but that's the reality of college sports. There's hundreds of thousands of different experiences, and we want to kind of let fans in and see what each are like.
And Olivia, if I'm hearing this right, the goal is not we're going to find the biggest stars in the biggest sports, you know, and profile the Heisman Trophy contenders and things like that. You're trying to get it sounds like a broad cross section of the people involved in college athletics. Do I have that about right?
Yes, you are definitely correct there. Chris just mentioned two basketball players, one that's plays for a men's team and one that plays for a women's. But coming up, we have stories from cross country runners and even from a women's wrestler. Iowa has the first Power Five conference women's wrestling team. So we will be sharing stories of tennis players, wrestlers, runners, really any sport that is in college sports. So definitely excited to be bringing a diverse array of storytellers to the table.
Chris, I wonder about generational change here. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that you were a college player, but now you're talking to athletes who really grew up in the social media world with the concept of people really presenting their own image. Are you hoping to capture some of that, that attitude?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the attitude. I graduated just 9 years ago, and in that time, so much has changed. Mm-hmm. I think young people, even if you aren't an athlete, it's so hard to grow up in the era of social media. Everything you do is observed, watched, talked about by your peers on social media. And I think that the volume is turned up on that when it comes to athletes. The recruiting process, your play on the field, anything you do off the field is kind of under a microscope. So that's come up with every athlete we've talked to. The mental health challenges associated with that have often come up as well. So a few things that we want to accomplish is, humanizing these young people. I think it's easy for fans to forget that they're complex individuals that are living lives outside of their performance on and off the field. So that's one thing that we're fascinated by. And I think also providing a healthier image for young people. Our readership, our viewership will, be as young as preteens and teenagers. And to see an athlete that you idolize be vulnerable, be honest, be earnest, I think there's a lot of power in that. And I think young people that read our stories will be able to see themselves in the athletes that are sharing stories outside of the court, outside of the field.
And Olivia, as the two of you roam the land talking to athletes, are you getting a lot of enthusiasm from the college athletes you talk to, a willingness and excitement to share their stories?
Yes, we are. They've just been so energized and refreshed to hear that a platform like this exists. Chris has talked a little bit about the community that we're creating, but I think athletes have, and college athletes specifically, have often been told what to say, how to say it. And now they feel really empowered and excited to share their story in their own words. These are multifaceted individuals, and to have a platform that they can share stories and experiences outside of sport, I think is a really new thing for them. And we've seen an incredible reception so far from the athletes themselves.
Chris, I could see an athlete being concerned, given, as you were saying, they're under the microscope. If they say the wrong thing, it could really come back to haunt them very quickly. How do you and the athletes you talk to navigate that?
Well, we take our time. I think we've all seen athletes interviewed immediately after a big win or loss, and they might be in the locker room and still feeling those emotions and say something they regret. Olivia and my approach has been to work with athletes. They draft what they want to say. If they want feedback, we can provide it. But we're in no rush. I think one of my frustrations at times being covered as an athlete was, being maybe the quote that I didn't want in was the one that was included, or, how I said something maybe wasn't what I meant on video. So we're patient with athletes and let them entirely control what they want to say. I think that's been, like Olivia said, something that's refreshing. It's, athletes can really take their time and think about the story that they want to share exactly how they want to. They are under, pressure. I think there's a, there's so many cliches in sports about not wanting to be a distraction or putting the team first. But what we see more and more, and I think this is close to recruiting, is that young athletes that are used to, you know, being on social media, sharing their story, want to go to a place where they can be themselves and be supported. So even with athletic departments that we've spoken with, understand the importance of the idea. And I think it's just the new media landscape in college sports. It's going to be about elevating athletes' stories and not as controlling as it's been in the past.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rob.
And Olivia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Olivia Hancock and Chris Borland are co-founders of a new athlete storytelling company, By Us Media. Olivia is a UW-Madison graduate. Chris played linebacker for the UW-Madison Badgers. They're with us today to talk about players using their own platforms to tell their stories instead of relying on traditional media. Up next, UW-Milwaukee sports media professor joins us for a look at the broader trend among players and what it means for the types of stories fans get to hear. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you and do you want to learn more about your favorite players? Do you follow athletes at any level on social media to get that direct contact? Do you want to hear more of their off-the-field stories? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how we get to know our favorite athletes, why many of them are switching to their own storytelling platforms instead of relying just on traditional news media. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow any kind of media to hear the personal stories, the life stories of athletes at any level? If so, where do you go for that? A newspaper, a news website, a sports website, or these platforms where athletes tell their own stories? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael Meirer is a visiting assistant professor of journalism at UW-Milwaukee, where he teaches about sports media. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here.
Michael, we just heard about this By Us effort here in Wisconsin. It's not the first platform trying to help athletes go direct to people with their own stories. What do you make of this trend, if it is a trend?
Well, it certainly is a trend. I think people are interested in taking advantage of the ability to speak directly to audiences. Pro athletes have done this for a long time. Now that college athletes are sort of able to monetize their personal images, I think it's becoming a more pressing question for college athletes, because the NCAA just, you know, stopped punishing student athletes for name, image, and likeness violations, right? They can now promote products. So developing a public persona and being able to speak outside of a media apparatus, I think, is of increasing value to college athletes.
Now, journalistically, I think, okay, for a politician, you know, if I'm a politician, of course, I want to be able to speak without the media intervening, but that may not necessarily be a public good, right? You want politicians to be challenged by, you know, some kind of third party from time to time. Is there any harm if we're talking about athletes instead of politicians?
So I think for both athletes and politicians, we should understand that they are speaking from a context, right? Athletes are telling, you know, athletes have a perspective and politicians have a perspective. The fact that they can say things does not mean that we should specifically believe them, right? So, you know, a politician goes on TV, an athlete makes a public statement, right? We as an audience have the right to, subject that to our reasoned analysis and criticize it if we find their statement lacking. We love having, you know, when journalists were in control, the idea that sort of bad ideas never got through is not, you know, that's not true, right? We're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, and certainly reporting failed in some cases there. Wrong information made it through, right? The presence of journalists, sadly, as I say this as a former journalist, doesn't guarantee us anything.
Right. I think of the old days of sports with all the myth-making and, you know, kind of creating characters like Yogi Berra, and Babe Ruth that were not necessarily real versions of who they are. Has traditional sports media gotten a little better, a little more authentic over the years, do you think?
I think it is. So there was a pushback in, you know, even at the time for the people who were building these people as like major symbols. If you go back and read sports journalism history, there's this divide between gee whiz and aw nut sports writers. And the gee whizers were the ones who, you know, wanted to turn athletes into symbols. But as the famous sports writer Robert Libsight said, you know, gilding the lily is not good to the lily, right? The flower dies. Making athletes into symbols didn't actually do the athletes any favors. It is dehumanizing on some level. It has us sort of turning them into symbols that we can use rather than understanding the athlete as a fully blooded human being.
Now, I also asked them about, and I want to hear you talk about this, the potential minefields. Athletes do get a lot of attention. They're responsible to themselves, their team, their teammates. Does it make sense in some cases for athletes to not want to take these kind of chances and put themselves out there like this?
I mean, for any media platform, you expect that some athletes are going to get themselves into trouble, right? I remember a few years ago, Pat Connaughton of the Milwaukee Bucks got in trouble for a cameo video that he made, right? It's a sort of fan service website. So people are going to get themselves in trouble, and managing media dynamics, though, is part of college sports, right? Especially at the higher levels, especially for sports that do generate a lot of media coverage. So there are going to be minefields. This is a new avenue for college sports to have to sort of contend with.
What about those athletes who aren't in those high-profile sports and high-profile programs? Do you see this as an opportunity for the public to learn more about their lives and for them to share a little piece of themselves?
I do. I think one of the things that we have seen in just the last couple of years as athletes have started to be able to sign endorsement deals, that it's not just football players and men's basketball players getting those deals, right? Athletes from all over the sporting landscape have been able to sort of make those connections with the public. Now, there are lots of sort of elements in there that we can debate and discuss in terms of racial dynamics, gender dynamics, but ultimately, right, it's this opening up of the media landscape does enable more participants, right? For good and for ill, it enables more participants. I think in this case, that we're hearing from people beyond just the traditional men's basketball, football duality, I think is probably a positive.
Any kind of media we talk about now faces challenges on the money side of things, the changing nature of advertising in print or on TV or online or what have you. This kind of stuff is no exception. Players Tribune, who feature direct stories from athletes, not a roaring success. They've had some good stuff. This new thing by us, no guarantee of success. What do you think is going to make the difference for the survival and thriving of an athlete-centered platform like this?
I mean, it's going to be adoption, right? It's going to be people sort of coming to it. It's going to be the ability for the platform to generate conversation, to put ideas in front of people. To get them to think about these things and discuss them. But the revenue side is a challenge for everything in media, even something like this. So, you know, I wish them the best of luck because I think it's an exciting idea to sort of make sure that like the range of college athletes are able to speak. I covered college sports for 6 years before I went on this academic path, and there are a lot of great stories and there's not enough time to tell them. And so it's going to be great to be able to hear from other people. And so the challenge will be sort of figuring out how to manage branding, how to manage advertising, how to sort of bring in enough money to keep the platform going.
As somebody who watches this, as someone who used to report on college athletics, what kind of stories, however they're presented, would you like to see more of?
You know, I want to see more of I'm a sucker for the behind the scenes stuff, the challenges that athletes face on a day-to-day basis. I think that stuff is really fascinating. So just the way you manage your life, like that's what I'm interested in, but I'm also interested in this, you know, the college experience is so alienating for somebody who's not also devoting 20 hours to sports, right? You're dropping down in a new location. You're meeting new people. You're embedded in a new community, right? Like, that's not a story we hear, right? That, you know, everything is sort of rooted, you know, the media apparatus is geared around toward game coverage and describing those, describing what happened in the game, right? This understanding what the challenges are on a daily basis. Like, I think that's, that insight is the stuff that I was always most fascinated by.
And we'll thank our guest, Michael Meyer, visiting assistant professor of journalism at UW-Milwaukee, where he teaches about sports media. He was with us today for a look at athlete-centered storytelling platforms. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, there are a lot of question marks in the economy these days. What does it all mean for you and your money? A personal finance expert joins the show with advice and answers to your questions. And you can get started right now. Is there a big question you have about how to manage your money, to invest it, thinking about mortgages and more? Email right now, ideas@WPR.org, then join the show tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Suppose you see a cat. And you want that cat to come over to you. What is the best way to communicate that notion? Turns out there's some new science behind that. A cat researcher in France put it to the test with some cats who live, and I guess work, in cafes. The experiment tried four different things. Ignore the cat, make a sound like pss, 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 but different in French, they do something different. Gesture, like, you know, a come here gesture, or gesture and make a sound. Now, sometimes I hear that cats always go to the person who doesn't want to interact with them and looks away from them. But nope, the cats in the experiment responded best to the people who made the sound and the gesture. If you got to choose, the gesture alone worked better than the sound alone. And when people totally ignored the cats, that led the cats to wag their tails more. That's not a happy thing like for dogs. That means the cats are confused at the lack of attention. Now, these are cats who like people. The study left out cats who just completely ignored people no matter what they did. There's probably a lot of cats. Interspecies communication news you can use. This is Central Time.